Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Vanity Fair.
I'm investing some moisturizer because the dehumidifiers turn your skin to a mummy's asshole.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss episode one of HBO's The Regime. The episode is titled Victory Day.
Today you'll encounter a soup tureen of worms known as the bureaucracy. Prepare yourself.
Happy Victory Day, madam.
And later on, Kate Winslet will be stopping by to talk about finding her inner autocrat and her big musical number. But first, before we kind of get into the recap, what do you guys think of the show so far? What are your initial thoughts?
I'm intrigued. Yeah. What about you, Chris?
I had no idea what to expect, and I found it to be funnier than I would have expected. Kate Winslet and her accent work, and sort of an egomaniacal chancellor who is also a hypochondriac, kind of tickled me, kind of made me laugh more often than I would have thought, though there is clearly danger present.
Well, the show does have some comedy roots, or comedy adjacent roots, in that it's from Will Tracy, who was a Succession writer. He wrote for John Oliver.
And The Menu.
The Menu.
Which feels like tonally very of a piece with this.
Totally. So I guess it's a satire of sorts. It has an Armando Iannucci-esque kind of worldview. It's pretty cynical, I think. Part of the reason when I was watching the first episode, I wasn't quite getting into the world as much as I hoped to, because its brand of cynicism maybe feels like too reminiscent of the real world or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I'm curious how that's going to kind of evolve as the season goes on.
Yeah. I will say that I think it adds a fun extra layer if we watch this show assuming that The Nation, that Kate Winslet is running, which we don't hear the name of. All we know is that it is somewhere in Middle Europe. But I'm choosing to believe that she is the Chancellor of Genovia. Of course, the country from The Princess Diaries. And that, you know, there has been some sort of a coup or...
Mia Thermopolis.
Government overhaul.
She had to step down.
Yeah, Mia had to step down. Somehow, Kate... I guess there was a chancellor before her and that now.
Right.
And now we have
now
Chancellor Elena in charge of the nation that used to be a sort of utopia. And look at what it's become.
Yeah, I think that calling it Genovia from here on out is what we have to do because, it's fun and it's easy. Because,
and I hope that Disney doesn't hear us do that and make us stop.
They're not litigious or anything.
I wouldn't
worry about it. Before we talk more about this episode, let's just do a quick recap. So this is for episode one. Corporal Herbert Zubek, a.k.a. The Butcher, is reassigned by the Chancellor.
This is a hygrometer. It measures humidity in the air. It helps you to tell me if there's mold nearby. We'll need you to follow me everywhere and take measurements. Do you understand?
Yes, I think so, Chief.
The Chancellor, played by Kate Winslet, has a raft of phantom medical issues. She's also courting American investment in her country's cobalt mines with a literal song and dance.
A love like ours is love that's hard to find. Ooh, how could we let
could we ever? You're so precious to me.
But a late night intruder rattles the Chancellor. She finds comfort in the butcher, who manages to foil the assassination attempt. The butcher and the Chancellor develop a special bond, and he convinces her that the finance minister and doctor are making her sick.
They want you crippled because you have something they will never, ever have. A fucking dream.
And now that the Chancellor is miraculously cured, she addresses her people to tell them of her new, stridently anti-American strategy.
We will no longer be a party to their legacy of brutality. We will no longer suffer for their greed.
I guess my first question about this first episode of The Regime is, how high did the stakes feel to you guys? Like, do you feel like there's a lot of, like, mortal threat? I mean, obviously, we see stuff toward the end that indicates that, like, you know, these people are in a precarious spot. But, like, does the comedy kind of outweigh the seriousness of the world it's depicting?
I suspect that you are asking a question that you have an answer to, Richard.
So before we say anything,
I guess I maybe in a kind of base way, I wanted a little more. I wanted it to be a little bloodier, I guess. Yeah.
So, I mean, it definitely feels like a choice that we are cloistered within the palace. We don't see the massacre at Site 5 that brings Zubak, our second lead character, to the palace. Definitely seems like an intentional choice to have the focus be entirely on the government and, you know, specifically Kate Winslet's chancellor, and the outside world feels completely removed. It doesn't seem to, you know, intrude at all on this very, like, isolated setting. And yeah, I don't know. I wonder if the walls kind of come down more as the show goes on. If there's some kind of bloody coup, you know, that would be a big, like, interesting reversal from, like, this very tight first episode. But yeah, I have to think that it's like that on, you know, on purpose. And, like, maybe as things go south, our palace gets invaded by, you know, the actual people that she is ruling over.
Yeah, we don't really ever see the actual people. And from a practical standpoint, I sort of understand, like, okay, if you have a palace, like a set like that, you kind of want to stay in it.
Sure.
You kind of want to use it for as much as you can. The opulence and the claustrophobia of a space like that also sort of sets the scene, and it gives insight into what the regime is, given that, you know, we see a newspaper headline, Butchers of Site 5, people are getting murdered in mines in cobalt mines and whatnot. And yet we're in, you know, a place that looks like we could be filming The Crown there, actually. I was like, wait, are we going back to a show that we've already covered? So I...
Yes, except that the rod in the palace in the regime is perhaps not a metaphor. Or not only a metaphor.
right.
Humidity, you know, the spores. And then I was like, okay, are we in The Last of Us? Now we're talking about spores? Like, I was like, we're doing a lot of things. HBO doing a lot of things that we've already done before. But I do, yeah, I think at some point, the real world or the actual citizens of our unnamed
which again,
country,
I think we should call Genovia.
Citizens of Genovia will, will
make themselves
batter
known.
Down. Yeah, will batter down those walls.
Yeah, I would have to assume so. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, how much are we supposed to be kind of racking our brain trying to find the real world analog for Genovia? I by the end of this episode, I was like, oh, you know what? I just have to kind of suspend disbelief. It's not trying to be necessarily a Balkan state, let's say, or
There's the accent issue, which is all I'm famously pedantic, and like it's sort of funny that we have like a very Eastern European accent coming from Zubak, like whatever Kate Winslet is doing, which I love her like weird frozen jaw thing.
Yeah. Margaret Thatcher-esque.
If you hear people from non-English speaking countries who are in like, you know, elite circles or positions of power, like they will have like these very posh accents.
Yeah, because they all get sent away to British boarding schools.
Right.
And, you know, few of them grow up in the states that they live. You
yeah,
know,
so
it's the Eton accent. It's the Harrow accent.
Totally. So, yeah, that part feels like a choice. But the kind of the mishmash of everybody else, yeah, I think we're going to suspend disbelief.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have...
Where is Middle Europe? I can't picture Europe in my mind. I can't tell you what it might be next
former
to.
Former Soviet bloc.
Do we have a map?
Like a Croatia kind of.
Yeah, it could be like Balkan. Could be Czechia. Balkan.
If you will indulge me and my cursory Googling post the episode, it could also be maybe like a Romania. So Elena, the name of the chancellor, is also the name of the wife of the communist dictator of Romania.
Ceaușescu.
I mean, this is my Romanian attempt to. So that could be an intentional nod. But yes, these were like very notorious totalitarians, like big cult of personality. There's a great episode of the Slate podcast Decoder Ring about how Romania under Ceaușescu like went crazy for Colombo. Like so mad that like this, they wind up debunking this. But there's a story that like Peter Falk would tell about how he was like secreted away like by the CIA to like record a message to the people of Romania being like, don't worry, you'll get more episodes of Columbo. Oh my God. Which is not actually what happened, right. But like that's the story that he would tell.
That's how people really think that David Hasselhoff was largely responsible for the Berlin Wall coming down. Yeah, that's actually
and that seems
thing.
Like that yeah. seems like the kind of thing I could see happening maybe like on this show, although it's not heightened in that way. Yet.
It's not, but you see a sort of pettiness and a kind of awareness of other nations and their position relative to that. Mm. You know, I think that we see a little bit of Orban, like the Hungarian head in this and little Putin. But I think that the show, at least from this episode, isn't really actually trying to do up to the minute newsy satire in the way that I kind of thought it would be. Another question I have about this pilot episode is, so Zubak, his arrival in the palace into the world of the chancellor is obviously kind of the inciting incident of this show. Do we think, based on what we've seen thus far, that he will be a good influence? I mean, we see him save her and so therefore kind of get in her good graces.
It seems pretty clear that, yes, there is. If there is mold, it is certainly not to the extent that she believes that it is there. Right. It is not as debilitating as whatever mental. And like her ministers are trying to feed that in order to get her out of the palace. Like that's.
Yeah, there is a soft power grab happening actually that is benefiting from the fact
that
she's
backstops.
I think it's interesting to have this person in the chancellor who is kind of positioned as a strongman-esque leader. Where this is called a democracy, but it clearly is not.
It's one of those you won with 97% of the
right.
votes.
Yeah. Right.
7 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And yet this actual, like, literal strongman arrives to possibly push her more into that? Or is he going to bring her out of it because now, like, she's, like, some, like, suspicious cohorts have been revealed and, she's, I guess, kind of consolidating her power. But yeah, I just can't really tell where the show like morally is kind of pointing. Like, is this going to be about the chancellor becoming better or getting worse?
Oh, it's not going to be about her becoming better.
Right? Yeah. It's going to be way worse, right?
Yeah. I think a cynical point of view, I think, can be assumed.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, yeah. I just wonder where Zubak kind of was going to factor into that. Like, are we looking at a budding romance? I can't really tell, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And I think you don't cast an actor like Matthias Schoenaerts without like having a lot for him to do, which is intriguing.
We meet her through his eyes, and he is a butcher of Site 5, so he has a sort of a tough backstory and has murdered people on behalf of the government. He was in the army, right?
And I do feel like in an unprovoked incident.
Yeah.
Yes. I do think it also, given like we're talking about where is Genovia, what is Genovia, he sort of represents more of like not that it's an ethnocentric country, but he seems to be of the people, salt of the earth, of the people, right? He's the only sort of outside the palace walls. He's our outsider inside that we get to follow into the regime. And it feels like he has a lot of strong ties to the country. He cares about his motherland in a way that maybe the people who are running the show, our chief finance officer and her personal doctor might not have a tie to the country in that way.
They seem interested in personal enrichment at all costs.
Yes, and continuing the regime and maybe even grabbing more power for themselves, but not for the benefit of the people. So I do feel that he has been brought in, maybe not to, you can't really corrupt the chancellor because she seems to sort of already not necessarily have everyone's best interests out, but I do think he's going to push her in a way that's more like, okay, what of the people of Genovia?
Yeah, yeah. And once a leader like that who is willing to sort of, power grab and all that stuff, once they do get that particular messaging shored up, like, no, I'm representing you, the common people, like, you know, very nationalistic, all that, then things can get even more dangerous, you know, and I guess maybe that's kind of where the show is pushing us.
Yeah, populism does not seem, at least in this context,
this version of it probably isn't good.
If it's all about not sucking on America's teat anymore,
right.
Like, what does that mean?
I liked that the resource they chose was cobalt, because that's a very, like, in the real world, like, a very fraught element or mineral, I don't know what to call it. Element, I guess, that mostly I think a lot of that mining is in Africa and it's really dangerous and there's a lot, you know, but like our cell phones need it for the batteries or whatever, like that positions this little country of Genovia as we're calling it, like as actually something that does have leverage in the world because this is a limited resource and people that is like very much needed. And I don't know. So the whole thing with her giving a speech saying we're kicking the Westerners away, like we're not going to deal with them. We're not going to kind of like suck up to them anymore.
I will not let you be sucked into the decadence and toxicity of America and its surrogates around the globe. For years we have suffered so they could build the global order in their image. They've provided material aid to corrupt regimes abroad. They committed and abetted mass murder, and they've waged their crony capitalist war in every corner of the planet. They have told the rest of us, play ball, sit up straight, do as we tell you, and pay the toll.
What is the show arguing about that version of global politics? Like, obviously, America has an undue influence on, like, too much of the world, and the show is kind of rejecting that, but it's also, in doing so, putting power in the hands of who seems to be a bad person. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Like, I guess it's kind of ambivalent, I suppose, is the...
So far, yeah. And I mean, and then you have Andrea Riseborough, who just seems to be, you know, trying to go along and get along and, like, survive. Mm. And, you know, she has a kid and she wants the best for him, you know, pretty, like, easy motivation. And those seem like, you know, she seems like the sympathetic character here.
Yes. Yeah. Poor Agnes. So the kid situation is that's her child, but the chancellor pretends it's hers. Like publicly?
I didn't get that. I just thought that the chancellor is like, you know, likes having him around.
Like
he's like a little pet, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. Oh, yeah. Basically, like, your son is actually my plaything.
Yeah.
My plaything. Yeah. Okay.
You know,
I don't have any responsibility.
Yeah. And then sends him away. And yeah, I mean, she doesn't seem like a family values type of lady. I mean, that Nikki had a wife and a child, and then she was like, no, you're going to marry me.
Because it's good for my campaign.
Yes.
Because it's good for my campaign.
Yeah. So that's one of the broader moments of the episode. Like, would he really be telling this to a bunch of strangers? Like, probably
and
not.
And at such length, and you can, the Americans are like, nodding.
We love Paris.
That's what I've never spoken to my family again.
Yeah. Which, like, that and, you know, her performance of a classic.
Yeah.
Delusional love song.
And Kate Winslet can sing, so that's good fake bad singing.
That was very entertaining.
It's very hard to do.
I found out also that the dictator of Turkmenistan is a dentist, like, turned politician who loves to make people watch him sing and rap.
That
could be.
Let's go to Turkmenistan.
There's something about people.
I'll meet you there.
And singing.
But yeah, no, like
they just love to force people to.
Yeah, I liked that. I liked the bigger moments of like kind of more overt comedy, like cringy. I don't know. Like I feel like Selena Meyer would have done that. Like made people watch her at her birthday party or whatever. Like sing badly and then make them clap for her.
Yeah. And it showed, you know, the depths of her narcissism. I mean, the scene with her smacking Herbert right after saying, I'm not ridiculous with her little lisp.
Yeah.
And then
very, very greathy.
Very greasy. Lisp for having a moment, you know.
Yes, our greatest Oscar-winning actresses doing silly little lisps is that's
to shield
the
their actual, to shield their true duplicitous and sort of evil nature is kind of interesting. But really, like the global politics and the America of it all, I wonder, given Kate and Elena's sort of like history, she clearly like is intelligent and whatnot, but I think that with the Herbert of it all, she's so clearly influenced. She's so narcissistic. Her ego is so fragile and yet so big that really she's looking for anyone to sort of steer her into causing a full-on war with America, which I don't think Genovia is sort of set up to do.
Probably not.
Right. So I don't know. I think,
but if there's a Ukraine nearby that they can invade or something like that,
right?
Maybe that's coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like viewed, you know, as a companion piece or follow-up to Succession. The Roy family was pretty powerful, but imagine if Kendall Roy could have a tantrum about Succession while also running a country.
Right.
Like, you know, I think it's a huge part of the portraiture on this show that the dad still looms so large in her mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite literally, that he's still physically present in her life.
Yeah, like, he's, you know, he's Lenin, yeah, you know, exactly. Just like lying there.
Yeah. I'm thinking about The Simpsons when Russia seems to be taking over and Lenin like gets out of his glass casket and says, must destroy capitalism. Yeah. Anyway. maybe that'll happen on this. Who knows?
Maybe. Wait, I have a question, mm-hmm. too, in terms of the meeting in dreams, that mm-hmm. sort of between the and mm-hmm. how seriously do we think we should take the fact that Elena feels like she's seen Herbert before? She's like, I'll see you in my dreams. That they sort of.
I like that you're calling him Herbert because you feel like very deep. You feel like a very deep bond with him.
I do. I like
it. To you, he's not the butcher.
He's not Zubek. No, he's not the butcher of Site 5. No, he's Herbert. No. Herbert and Elena the Chancellor. But yeah, I don't know how much we should. How much do you think we should be reading into that connection? Is it just chemistry that they have, or is it something deeper?
Yeah, it seems like some offhand thing she said, like maybe to kind of fuck with him, mm-hmm. At the very, you know, in that first meeting. But yes, she is more easily influenced than she probably like would admit to being. And him, he seems, he has kind of the heart of a zealot, and he clearly very much believes in her. And I don't know if he actually thinks that he's had these dreams or he just wants to connect with her or what, but it does seem like whatever connection was maybe kind of floated as a joke, and they're both coming to believe that it's real.
Yeah. She's clearly unhinged, but he also might be unhinged too.
Well, yeah. I mean, you see him walking through the halls, slapping himself and saying, kill yourself.
There's that. Yeah.
This is not a well man. He did those inclined push-ups very well.
He did. Really? And those mountain climbers?
No, he has a whole body weight circuit worked out, which is great because you can work out anywhere.
That's true. Yeah, you know, that's the thing. He doesn't need a gym.
He doesn't need equipment.
He doesn't need a gym. Do we want to see them kiss? Do we want to see them get together in that way?
I mean, Nikki seems like a weak little slime ball, so I don't think I'm rooting for him.
No, it feels sort of inevitable to some degree.
He does speak French, which is attractive.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I agree, Chris. I think they wouldn't set up this dynamic in the way they already have in the first episode without some version of that mm-hmm. making itself apparent. But I don't also think that given that, you know, who made the show and how the show is already sort of pitched tonally, I don't think it's going to be a romance.
No, it's not The Bodyguard.
Yeah, right.
We're not watching The Bodyguard here. Yeah,
although.
We're not?
Oh. We could.
Maybe. Maybe we could be. But yeah, I think that tonally I agree, Richard, that maybe it's a little scattered. But I think that there's a lot of really good details. I love Kate Winslet, like I said, facial tick or whatever she's doing. Yeah. I think that that's like a fun character choice. I love that she says, you know, we can't have salmon because it's weak. Like little, there's little turns of phrase that I think work very well. You know, when all of the ministers are waiting for her. It is very much like watching Jerry and Carolina and whoever from Succession like gossip before the Roys come in. But I miss that show.
No, that is a fun energy. I think also by the end of this episode, I was glad. I mean, you know, this is a fictional person. I can root for a fictional, awful person. Mm-hmm. I was glad to see her a bit more like maybe a little bit out of the sort of germophobia, all that stuff, and a little bit more centered and empowered, because like that's more of the stuff I want to see. Like, I think it will be more fun if she's very imperious and sort of, you know, cruel and all that stuff. As much as I thought that Winslet was great at doing the stuff where she, you know, she's like scared of stuff in the walls and kind of like losing her mind, I had sort of tuned in wanting to see her be like the Iron Fist. And then so I think we're going to get there maybe in episode two.
You know, I think a woman can be both.
You know what?
Scared of germs and also rule with an iron.
She can be a paranoid lunatic and a strong, powerful lunatic.
I think that's a great message for the young women.
The youth of America.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with our Chancellor, Kate Winslet.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz. Who should be the mayor of New York?
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room. All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Okay, I, for one, absolutely, wholeheartedly believe that every world leader should have to sing 16 bars before getting elected.
Like a talk sing thing where you're adding in some ad libs. I completely agree.
An audition, if you will. I think it's important.
I think you're right on the money. And I think we're going to find out whether Kate Winslet believes the same thing, because we have an interview with her. Kate Winslet takes on this role. She also is an executive producer of the show. She's had several great collaborations with HBO in the past, Mildred Pierce and Mare of Easttown. And yeah, we're very excited that our colleague David Canfield got to talk to her.
Yeah, you normally hear David with me on Vanity Fair's other podcast, Little Gold Men. So we're really happy to have him be joining the Still Watching family for this big interview. I'm curious to hear the conversation, because Kate Winslet is no stranger to HBO, but comedy is sort of a newer thing for her. So I'm curious to hear her kind of talk about that and, maybe give us some teasers about what to expect for the rest of the regime.
Kate Winslet, thank you so much for being here. We're going to talk all about episode one of the regime. To start, it is such a pleasure to see you get to be funny. I haven't seen you do a ton of comedy lately. Can you talk about just walking into that space, how that maybe changes your chemistry as an actor at all?
So did I make you laugh then?
You made me laugh a lot.
Okay, that's so good. Oh my God. Thank you so much. See, look, I'm just like my character. I just want approval and love. Affection.
Okay. I'm seeing the connection already.
Yes. You see, there's so many similarities. No, there's none. So I had to accept early on that I was nothing like this character, and that there was nothing in her that I had ever come across before. And this was just a role. I just had never played anything like this.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Like, to do something funny that is clever, that's the dream. I mean, really it is. You know, I have always wanted to do comedy and hoped that the right thing might, you know, show its face at some point. And so to be delivered 6 episodes of just delicious outrage, set in an unreal imagined place with characters that don't exist, it was just irresistible. I mean, and because it's set against a geopolitical backdrop, and yet these characters are totally invented, it meant that us as actors had so much freedom. I mean, I have to be honest, it did give us artistic license to really go to town. But then also I had to learn quite quickly that to make something funny, you can't just like try and do a funny. You can't be funny. You have to play it straight, and you have to really rely on the lines behind it, and you have to rely on the other actors to bring it, and you have to really kind of watch each other and learn that sometimes the humor can just be in the rhythm, in the pauses, in the looks. You know, I mean, some of the opportunities I had to just do a teeny tiny little face thing and not talk. And learning that, and learning how to use that as punctuation sometimes. I learned a lot every day, like literally every day.
I can imagine. Yeah, I think to that point, you have to sort of build the character in a similar fashion, right? She has to have the same kind of building blocks. How did you talk to Will Tracy and the team about exactly who this woman was and how you would walk through spaces, what those looks would look like, as you say?
Well, I knew right away that it wasn't going to make sense for me to play her using my own voice. I knew that. And we talked about that as a team early on, Stephen Frears and myself, Jessica Hobbs and Will. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion around that. Well, why wouldn't you use your own voice? And the main point for me was that when you put a character with a clear, concise, typical RP accent in a palace, the second that person opens their mouth, the audience is going to think that it's a monarchy, that it's royalty. And we have had many shows in recent years about real royal families. And this is an imagined world. And so we had to welcome everyone's voices that they wanted to bring in. So that's why Matthias uses a version of almost his own accent. Guillaume Gallienne is French. Andrea Riseborough is originally from the north of England. And she chose to honour, actually, some of her ancestry, who were people of service, in going with that voice. So for Elena, I knew that I had to find something and make it believable. And so what I did was I really tried to concentrate on her whole life. And in particular, her childhood. And actually, I worked a little bit with a neuroscientist and a psychologist to try and understand trauma and exposure to trauma and how that can impact on someone's physical self and mental self. Oh, wow. Obviously, this is a woman who is in a declining mental and imagined physical state of decline. And that has to come from somewhere. It's not something that's just happened. It's probably always been with her. And so once I decided... And with Stephen and Jess together, we agreed that her childhood was probably fairly traumatic and that there was clearly something not quite right about the relationship with her father, that would have stayed in her in a very significant way. And as she had risen to power, perhaps there were certain things that she would do, whether it was become really paranoid about germs or distrustful of people, not wanting to go out, which is a more of a recent thing in our story. How she moves, how she speaks, how she holds herself. We allowed for those things to be manifestations of something more traumatic that had learned to live inside of her body, but that she had had to learn how to hide. And so I then realized that I was playing someone who was always wearing a mask of some kind. And once we settled on that, it then gave us the freedom to really explore the theatrics. So she could then dress in ways that are almost absurd, you know, being sometimes overtly sexual with just how tight those costumes are that I was occasionally sewn into. because she uses her physical self in a way that is completely inappropriate at times, but simply because she doesn't have the emotional language with which to communicate what she thinks, how she feels. You know, she thinks that being powerful just means they love me. They see, look. They think I'm beautiful. Mm. See, I look nice, don't I? Yes, I look nice. Okay, let's go. She's constantly asking people, does she look nice? Never waiting for a response and always just telling it to herself. So these weird sort of twisted affirmations that go on are all part of her sickness, really. And then, of course, she falls in love with the most unlikely of characters, but really actually falls in love and becomes somewhat obsessed by him as he does with her, which we see. And then her whole power trajectory goes extremely pear-shaped because she just listens to him perhaps a little bit too much.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, yes.
It's fascinating, though, the amount that goes into this psychology that you're describing, and yet the task ultimately is to make her funny, like you were saying at the beginning. It's a strange question, but how did you find that experience, like, especially knowing all that a lot of this is coming from pain, trauma, etc., and then spinning it in a way where we can laugh?
I think you just have to be prepared as an actor to be able to laugh at yourself, you know, to not be able to take yourself too seriously. So I had to just drop all that. I had to not worry about whether people thought I was funny or not funny, or, you know, I had to learn very quickly that was just like bullshit self-indulgence. Just stop all that. But the script was, you know, the script was so strong, and the humor, and the darkness of the humor, the satirical rhythm of the humor was so abundantly clear to all of us that we as actors all walked through the doors and into the same damn room when it came to what story we were telling. And that was enormously helpful. And actually, I have to say, like, a lot of the actors we were working with have done comedy in the past, you know, mm-hmm. and I realized quickly, okay, yeah, right. Okay, so you play it straight, you know, that thing I had to learn so damn quickly that. And comedy just isn't funny if you're trying to make it funny. It's the circumstance. It's the absurdity of what they're doing, that world, what they're saying. And it's everything. It's that entire universe. It's not just any one thing at any given time. And so as a sort of a collaborative creative team, we all had to really kind of, we absolutely had to listen to one another, really. And it was so lovely to have that. It was really and truly, there was no sense of people being in their different departments. It was all one thing, and we had to all work together. It was just fantastic.
Can I ask you about the singing? particularly, like, doing a great job at singing poorly. I think that's a really unique task, right?
Oh, my God. So Will Tracy had created this brilliant scene where she stands up and she sings for her people as though it's something that maybe she often does at these kind of state dinners. You know, that's her little gimmick, right? Mm-hmm. And so I damn well learned to sing that song well, which is, by the way, a hard song to sing, okay? So we go into Abbey Road, which is where Alexandra Desplat records everything.
Yep.
So it's an incredibly exciting moment. I'm standing on the fucking stage where the Beatles recorded everything and I can't believe it. And here I am singing this song. And they're all up in the recording booth and I can see them in this big glass box. And there's Stephen Frears like this. And he looks sort of a bit grumpy and I'm thinking, oh, fuck, I better get it right. So I sing the song, like, confidently and, you know, well, I'd been practicing. Mm-hmm. And I get to the end and he goes, through the window, he just shakes his head. I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, what? So this little person, little Stephen, walks from behind the glass door, opens the actual door of the stage and starts to walk down the steps towards me. And I'm going, what? What is it? Is it horrible? He goes, no, I just don't understand. Huh. I don't understand why she's singing well. Why? Why? I said, because that's written in the script. And he said, no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. I said, okay, oh my God, what are we going to do? Thinking, shit, he's going to change the song. We've only got today to record it. And then we're all going up to the Peak District where we're filming up there this afternoon. And he said, sing it badly. And I'm like, okay, now I get it. And the second I started singing it badly, this window framing all these phenomenal professionals suddenly became a cackling, giggling mass of hysterical people who could not stop laughing. And I was like, okay, that's the way we're going to do it. And it's actually quite difficult to sing badly.
Right.
I mean, not sing badly, but to find, like, the really bad version of the bad key. Mm-hmm. It's quite hard to do and keep doing the same thing every time. Oh, my God.
You nailed it.
And but what's so clever about that on Stephen's part is that it is literally a free pass handed to the audience that says to them, this is meant to be absurd. She is delusional. Like, it's literally a creative instruction almost, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay. Okay, I can relax a little bit now. He's given me a bit of a free pass here. This is great. And it was honestly so much fun. So much fun.
What a way to walk into a character. She is delusional. This is ridiculous.
but she absolutely is. And I just embrace that. There's no point trying to make it real. It's not. It's not meant to be.
Well, to that point, I'd love to close by asking you, even beyond the absurdist confines of this show, if you did look at all to the rest of the world, to the you know, there's no shortage of terrible leaders we've had in our history and recently. Like, if there were any models for you in terms of how she actually governed, how she spoke to her people, things like that.
You know, it just wouldn't have been a safe place for me to go. I just decided she's really not like anyone I've ever come across. And leaning on the theatrics of her was something I felt was was just a better option. I just had never come across anyone like this. I mean, she's Elena Vernum. She's completely unique. It's like no one else I'd ever played. And I wanted to really make her totally my own and like no one else I'd ever played before. And so in order to do that, I just dug right into the character. You know, the thing is, there have been horrendous dictators for centuries, mm-hmm. and there will be for centuries to come. And people will draw from the show whatever they choose to, precisely because of that geopolitical backdrop. But it was my job to always make sure that I was sticking by the choices that I was making to play this delusional, ridiculous woman living in a fictional country in an invented part of Central Europe. And actually, I had more freedom that way, you know? Mm-hmm. I really had much more freedom, and I felt that we could lean on we could lean on how neurotic she was, how paranoid she was, how insecure she was. I mean, there was so much freedom I gave myself to explore such a wide-reaching range of, I suppose, elements of her mental health area. And it was important to me to do that so that she just became fuller. The larger than life she was, the safer I was going to be. So I was very lucky that I was encouraged to stay in that direction.
I think I can speak for all viewers to say we were all quite lucky that you were in that space. Kate Winslet, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, we'll make our predictions for who will lead the regime at the end of the series.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we are going to end each week of our coverage of the regime by taking a guess of who we think might be leading the nation in the end. You know, our opening credits show the flag getting increasingly tattered, and then it falls, and then it rises again. And, like, mm-hmm. does that mean the new leader is coming? Who knows? So who do we think that the chancellor is going to be by the end of the series?
Well, okay. We should say, by the way, that the winner gets a one-way ticket to Turkmenistan.
Yeah. Whoever gets and closest. And a free concert, right.
A meet and greet.
Yeah.
Meet and greet.
With a man whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce.
Oh, sure. No.
Couldn't even if you paid me.
All right.
My guess is it's Agnes's son, and thus by proxy, Agnes herself. So I'm going to take the naive view that by the end of the regime, good wins out.
Wow. Okay. Meek shall inherit the earth.
Correct.
Yeah. That's okay.
I like that because, yeah, it's one of those like in front of you, but like maybe twisted enough that it's not super obvious.
And maybe it's the last moment of the season or the show mm-hmm. implies that maybe that the kid is being corrupted too. And so maybe he's not. It's not going to be that good anyway.
Well, certainly being raised from like childhood as, you mm-hmm. know, a prince. Is something that's great for one's mental health and self-esteem.
Yeah, listen to our The Crown episodes for more on that.
Nothing bad happened to
Andrew. Yeah, Google Prince Andrew. Okay, so I'm going to also kind of go left field. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, the obvious answer is like a Zubek or like one of the finance minister or whatever, people who got kicked out. We know that Hugh Grant is going to be on this show.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't know who he is yet. He's not in this episode.
Yeah.
I feel like somehow Hugh Grant is going to wind up in charge. Maybe as his Wonka Oompa Loompa character.
I was about to say.
Maybe as the prime
Oompa
minister
Oompa Loompa.
From Love Actually. Maybe just as star of the screen, Hugh Grant.
Exactly.
Maybe he plays a character. I don't even know. I'm going to say that, yeah, I feel like he has something to do with the end game.
Okay.
If it ended and then it Love Actually immediately starts. I guess that would be.
Oh yeah! If this whole time it's actually been like prequel 1998, then that's a fun twist too.
I'll go straight down the middle and go for my guy Herbert Zubek, and say maybe it's a story about how you can rise from nothing, and you know you get in your way, and you know a sort of the favorite, you work your way all the way to the top, and you know absolute power will then corrupt all and whatnot. I mean that's a little like I feel like that's too paint by numbers. I don't think the show will necessarily do that. But I do think Herbert's shooting to the moon. I think he's only getting more and more power. We saw him, you know, come in as, you know, chief humidifier taker, get knocked down to 6 a.m., to the 6 a.m. slot, save her life. I think he's now curried favor, and I think he can manipulate her. And if not him, then someone in his orbit, somebody from outside the palace walls.
His darling mother or something, yeah.
His beetroot. friends.
That reminds me. We didn't really talk about the assassination attempt.
Oh yeah, which is kind of interesting because she was more concerned about breathing the air of the guy than the fact that he could have killed her. He was like, I can't believe we breathe the same air. It wasn't really even that like, oh, this man.
Well,
was
yeah, because he came from
bedroom.
The outside. He is tainted. But do you think that he was sent by the people who she blamed for?
I think he was a random crank.
You think so? Yeah. You don't think that somebody in the palace had something to do with it?
No, because I feel like the way that he was kind of like this. Yeah, he was just like, I think it was like a weird impulse, and then maybe he was not well in the mind
because he didn't just like go for it.
Right.
He wasn't
on a mission. Okay. It was like it just felt like what am I doing here?
I don't know. I kind of read that as like, he's being paid. He's like some poor, cobalt miner, like sugar beet farmer from way out. Like he doesn't actually want to be here. He's terrified to be doing this, but somebody has paid him off. And that's why he's hesitating. And I think that somebody in the circle, I don't think it was Kate Winslet who like would have set him on herself, but like, I don't know, it could have been her husband.
Could have been the Americans. True. That is true.
Americans love to send assassins to kill foreign leaders.
What are you talking about, Hillary?
I have heard maybe.
It's never happened.
And it did like totally like, I don't know, voting for RFK Jr. or something.
Oh no.
Oh God. Oh my God. It did remind me of that episode of The Crown where, you know, a man just broke into the queen's bedroom and they just sort of sit and have tea all day. So there's a precedent for this.
There is, I suppose. But yeah, and the fact that happened, I don't know, she's not safe. People are coming.
And
people are plotting.
Apparently the palace is pretty easy to get into, so that's something that they should probably look
crack
into.
Crack open a window.
Well, they spend all that time on fake mold mitigation. They don't have any real security.
It's true.
It's expensive.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. If you have any questions, theories about who's going to be in control of Genovia by the end of the season, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com and we'll try to read the best ones on air. And you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Chris Triss.
And you can find me at Hillabuster with two R's.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for episode 2. Looking forward to seeing you then, comrades.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.